This is your Richie Allen Show, live on Fab Radio 2 in Manchester. Tune in radio and davidicke.com. Let's welcome our next guest to the programme. He's a good friend of mine. I have a lot of time for him. He's a great broadcaster. You can catch his weekly politics show on BCFM. It's called The Politics Show. Great listen. And I will tweet out links to where you can hear it if you've not heard it before. He's a former BBC journalist. And if we ever have a museum dedicated to the Bilderberg Group, he will be the curator of that museum, because there is nobody better versed in the history, the historicity, and the workings and inner dealings of the Bilderberg Group. Let's welcome back to the programme our friend Tony Gosling. Tony, welcome back, mate. Always great to have you on.
Thanks for bringing me up, Richie. That's lovely. But I would also add something to what you're saying about the Bilderbergs there, at least something I've figured out, I think, probably in the last few years, particularly after going along to these meetings, because I think rather than studying these things from at home, it's a good idea to actually go, you know, because one of the things that happens is loads of people from all over the world who are thinking along the lines we are, basically, that we're being ruled by a bunch of bankster, corrupt, elite, misguided, shall we say, souls, we can all get together and we can all share our knowledge of what's really going on. And there's something that I would say is that Bilderberg isn't really where the big decisions are made. It's a kind of recruitment shop, really. It's about where the future leaders are looked at and by the people who really run things, and they're, I suppose, tested a bit, you know, sort of, what do you think about this, what do you think about that. They're put in the spotlight, and then afterwards the people that really run things, your Henry Kissingers and people like that, will go back and say, well, how do you think that person got on? And they can compare notes and say, well, I think maybe that person should be the next person to run Britain or America or Germany. And, you know, that, at least to be the puppet that's in charge or in front of the cameras. So that's Bilderberg. There's something else behind it, which I don't know how familiar you are with the Pinay Circle, but these people are effectively a kind of fascist international. They've had people like Michael Ankrum as their chair. I'm not sure if he was chair, but also Jonathan Aitken. All these extreme right conservatives, you know, verging on the authoritarian in public, even. Yeah. A part of this what is effectively a kind of ex-intelligence service club, much more secretive than Bilderberg, but I think is in much more involved in actually steering policy direction, particularly when it comes to making sure that the politicians are doing what the arms companies want, and they're actively going out there grabbing new resources, grabbing new territory, which seems to be their obsession.
Interesting stuff, Tony. We chatted briefly today on Skype. I asked you to come on because I'd be very honest. I'm always honest with me. Somebody who was due to be on tonight couldn't come on. You're the first person I thought of, particularly because of the news today. So I'll give Tony a shout. I suppose we shouldn't be surprised that MI5 have their own internal review has cleared them of any serious mistakes in what happened in Manchester, of course. And then, of course, the review of the reviews, which is what the BBC are reporting on this evening, says that mistakes were made, but you know, these things happen, and, you know, blah, 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 move on, pass the butter, and nothing to see here. But Tony, we know, and you and I have talked about this, that there's some very serious questions to answer about the relationship UK intelligence services had with Ramadan Abedi, the father of Salman Abedi, the man whom we're told blew himself up back in May. This has the hint or the sniff of a whitewash about it. What do you think?
Well, of course it is. I mean, look at who is in charge here? Is it Downing Street or is it number 12 Milbank, MI5? MI5 are running the show now. They're a permanent government, effectively. And Theresa May was one of their choices to be the Prime Minister, because as a Home Secretary, she was supposedly in charge of MI5, and she was extremely cooperative with them. As I heard a few weeks ago from Graham Fawkes, who lost his son in the 7/7 bombings, basically he'd been to see her several times and had face-to-face meetings with her, but was ignored. Now, if she's going to ignore the families of the people who die in terrorist attacks, she's making it very clear whose side she's on when it comes to protecting the public. So that's, I think, why she has been manoeuvred into the position now with no election within the Conservative Party at all, to be sitting in 10 Downing Street in a very, very fragile, sticky wicket she's on too. So, you know, that should say it all, really, as to what's going to... I mean, there is supposed to be oversight of the security services. So that's the main ones that we're allowed to know about. And, of course, there will be others, is GCHQ, which is doing signals intelligence, then MI5, which is doing domestic intelligence work, and MI6 doing foreign intelligence work. There's supposed to be oversight of these by a Commons committee called the Intelligence and Security Committee. The actual day-to-day running of it is by another committee, but this is MPs are supposed to be Intelligence and Security Committee. Now, I was looking at this the other day, and I can't see that they have actually met this since this latest general election. So I'm not sure if there even is a Intelligence and Security Committee in the moment, because I can't see any record of their deliberations. All I can say, I think, about this thing today with David Anderson QC talking about MI5s are exonerated from any kind of mistakes that led to Manchester, is talk to the families of those that have died. You will find they are not at all happy. We had on Channel 4 News this evening somebody who lost, I think it was his daughter or his son, in the Manchester attacks. Combined with others who've been being killed over the, you know, with the 7/7 bombings, what you've got here is the same people in charge with various terrorist attacks, and no oversight, really no kind of accountability. So that's why people are getting annoyed. Number one, because we've got a prime minister who's incredibly close to the security. So I was chatting to Charles Shoebridge on the radio a few months ago, and what he said was MI5 don't have a press office because they don't need any press officers, because the domestic London media's domestic Home Affairs correspondents are their press officers. They just say whatever MI5 wants them to say. There's very little criticism. So that's this. We're in a sort of dangerous, dodgy zone, anything to do with these domestic security services. And that's why I was really cross today to see this insulting. I mean, the amazing thing is that they've actually produced this report, an internally commissioned report, because Parliament has not even had any kind of oversight. It hasn't done any proper investigation. So it's like they're writing their own school report, Richie.
Yeah, that's right. And there's been no parliamentary hearing. There's been no call for Andrew Parker to appear in front of a parliamentary committee and answer questions about what they were told before the Manchester bombing. 4 days before the bombing, Salman Abedi came back to Manchester. We were told later on, after the bombing happened, that the intelligence agencies around Europe were telling us that this guy was deadly. They were told he was deadly. They were told by the French intelligence. They were told by the Turkish authorities that this guy had been to Syria and he was very, very, very dangerous. And you just have to wonder.
And Libya.
That's right, Tony.
And the thing is that Salman Abedi, who is supposed, we haven't really, I don't think, got 100% evidence that he did it.
No.
But assuming that he did, his father was a long-time agent of MI6.
Yes.
Over in Libya. He was arrested, but before he was arrested over in Libya, he managed to do a couple of press interviews in which he said, well, Salman Abedi, my son, was coming to Libya because he was talking about spending more time over here, and he was coming over for Ramadan, and there's no way he did it because he's not that sort of person and he wasn't at all interested in this sort of thing. There's also the fascinating evidence of Dawn Waddy, who spoke to, I think it was Sky News, actually outside the Manchester Arena the day after, explaining that she'd seen somebody who was extremely suspicious sitting next to her, who didn't speak English and couldn't really communicate with her, but she was fiddling with her bag, she wasn't watching the concert, and she reported them to the security, and the security did nothing about it. In fact, security said to her, how would you like it if someone pointed you out as suspicious? Now, that to me is not a security company that's taking security seriously at all. So there's lots and lots of questions to answer about Manchester. But the most important one is, why have Why haven't we had some kind of public hearing of MI5 officers who were supposed to be keeping an eye on Abadi, who, by the way, had also been reported on the anti-terrorist hotline? So it's almost as if this anti-terror hotline is a recruitment tool for MI5. So they're actually bringing people up. See, I would say I think MI5 are complicit in these terrorist attacks. I don't just think it's an accident. Because there is this very close contact with MI6, this long, long relationship between British intelligence and the CIA and Islamist terrorism, right the way back to the 1980s, Richie. You and I know this, yeah. With Operation Cyclone in Afghanistan, right the way through to the Arab Spring, which was actually cooked up by the RAND Corporation over in the US and then rolled out as a way of actually in Egypt, the effect of it was, for example, to just flush out who were the real political activists in the entire country. And they were all incarcerated after the Morsi government, and many of them executed by the Sisi after the Sisi military coup in Egypt. So it was a way of flushing out political activists and killing them. That's effectively what the Arab Spring ended up doing in Egypt anyway. This relationship between the Islamist terror, so-called, which is, I think, mostly funded by the West, and what happened in Manchester should be absolutely obvious to anyone. In fact, I even had a contact the other day emailing me, say, oh, yes, I remember I used to go past the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group's base in Manchester, because that's where they were based. The people who we were trying to get to overthrow Gaddafi through terrorism.
That's right.
And we were funding them to do it. So, you know, this is the real story of Manchester, which still hasn't been told, certainly not by this David Anderson QC character.
No, and David Shaler, former MI5, 4 or 5 days after the bombing in May, contacted the UK government, gave them all the information he had from when he blew the whistle on MI6's activities in Libya. And talking about Salman and Ramadan Abadi, David Shaler said to us on this programme, he said, Richie, don't forget that after the Soviet-Afghan war, many hundreds, maybe even into the, the thousand number, or maybe a couple of thousand, Al-Qaeda, heavily trained, very seriously trained, guerrilla fighters, some with extreme opinions, were basically repatriated to the United Kingdom. And he said, we've never had a discussion about that, about who those people were, what their ideas were. You know, did they integrate into UK society over the last 20, 25 years, or did they not, or what's gone on? There's so much, Tony, that nobody in what we call commercial or national media wants to touch. These are questions they won't touch. And
well, they
tiptoe
around it, don't they? Sometimes they sort of hint at it occasionally, and it was really good actually to see on Channel 4 News tonight one of the families of one of the victims actually having a say and saying what everyone else in the whole country is thinking, that MI5 are totally out of control and that they're not actually doing their job, you know, which they're being paid massive amounts of money for. Instead, they're begging more money every time something else goes wrong. So they're on a making budget. I think they call it budget creation, don't they? They're actually trying to justify more money for themselves every time there's a terror attack rather than stopping them. I mean, I think most of us can remember this in the context of Northern Ireland too, with the MI5 being totally untrustworthy in all sorts of ways. And, in, you know, the parallel, I suppose, there is also the use of religion, you know, because the way that the sectarian divides were exacerbated in Northern Ireland was one of the things which helped, you know, sort of exacerbate the troubles, exactly as the same sort of thing is going on between the Sunni and the Shia in Islam, you know, sort of funding extreme versions of all sides and trying to fuel the flames, I suppose, of discord.
We can segue, Tony. Sorry to interrupt you. We can segue neatly into something now, because you've had a tweet, which is an interesting tweet. I'll read the tweet. Just before I read the tweet, Tony's going to talk about...
God, what have I said now?
Oh, no, it's good. The former president... Yeah, the former president of Yemen, Ali Abdullah Saleh, was killed yesterday, and allegedly he was killed by Houthi rebels while trying to flee Sana'a. Now, on foot of that. You've had a tweet about that, and it's from Kenneth Lambie, who says, Richie, Yemen suddenly in the news, basically he's talking about the assassination of Saleh, described as a proxy war between the Saudis and Iran. Will this be hyped up and used as an excuse for neocon war with Iran? Is this Yemen situation, which has been, you know, getting progressively worse over the last couple of years, is it going to be used as an excuse to do what? I mean, we heard Benjamin Netanyahu address the Israeli people on Monday, was it, or Sunday? It was Sunday, basically giving a tirade and a rant about Iran, and Iran had to be stopped. Is that, do all roads, including what happened in Yemen yesterday, all roads lead to Iran, Kenneth wonders?
Well, he's right, of course. Not that all roads are actually leading to Iran as a perpetrator of very much, but that there's definitely an attempt to cook up a war between the Israelis and in Iran. This has been going for a long, long time. I mean, ever since the Iranian Revolution, really, there's been just a hatred of the fact that you've got a very, you know, actually the culture, the Persian culture is enormously historic, you know, and it can't be just hijacked by, you know, the West putting its puppet in charge. So the Iranians were almost like ready for the Shah, you know, when he was controlling things, and decided, right, well, we've got rid of fake foreign puppet leaders before, so we're going to do the same to you, mate. You know, so they did back in 1979. Immediately, a lot of people forget this. There was a massive bomb attack on the new revolutionary government there. The cabinet were blown to pieces by the Americans. So as soon as they tried to start a new country after having gotten rid of the Shah, there was the most horrific terrorist attack. And the Americans and the French have been, possibly the Brits too, I don't know, but have been funding something called the MEK, which is a terrorist group, which is disgruntled Iranians and also people from other parts of the world who decided for whatever reason they're going to take, well, mercenaries effectively taking money from the West to try and destabilize Iran. But you know, this is being definitely cooked up. I mean, it's interesting as well to hear that Trump is going to be trying his best to get Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, even though it looks as if now Congress is going to stop him making it the capital. In other words, you know, saying that they really, you know, the Americans will recognize it as the capital, but they're saying that they want to recognize the aspiration of Jerusalem as the capital, so America can start to recognize it as the capital, but not actually move the embassy. So they're making all sorts of, you know, moves in that direction. But this is effectively this Zionist fundamentalist agenda, which is part of a whole kind of quite secretive plan to move. I mean, it started obviously with the recognition in 1948 of the State of Israel and the Balfour Declaration 100 years ago. We've had all that those commemorations recently. So it starts really with the Jews remain God's chosen people. So they've got this kind of super exceptional, you know, we are the greatest kind of attitude, which is a little bit reminiscent of things in the past where we've seen totalitarian kind of race stuff going on, particularly in Germany. And then you've got the restoration of the scriptural lands. So you had all this stuff going on in the Old Testament where the land of Palestine was supposed to be, well, it was back in those days, restored to the Jewish people. So they want that all again, even though, of course, you're going to kick a load of Palestinians out, and they will, of course, want their land back at some point in the future. Then you've got Palestinian, not just Palestinians being removed, but Palestine becoming exclusively Jewish. So that means actually removing by any means all the Palestinians from there, including the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem, which, by the way, is still supposed to be under the UN mandate there. It is supposed to be an Arab controlled East Jerusalem. It's not, it's occupied. That's then right. You've got then you've got this idea of moving the capital of Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Then you've got the final, well, get nearly to the final, you've got the rebuilding of the Third Temple. Well, that would be nice, but you're going to have to be careful not to upset the Muslims with their Dome of the Rock and other buildings on the Third Temple site. And then finally, is war, because they believe, many of the Christian Zionists believe, war is inevitable. Therefore, there's no point in trying to have peace, and that God has prescribed this war for the future. So this is this rather worrying agenda that seems to be being played out by Trump, even just this week, with trying to get the capital again moved from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem.
Let me just, because I go along with that, but I wonder how much of Trump's timing is down to the pressure that Netanyahu finds himself under. We know that over the weekend, 20,000 protesters rallied in Tel Aviv against Netanyahu, who whether he's guilty of the corruption charges that he is facing, I can't say that. Much as I detest Netanyahu, we have to be proper journalists. We can't say that he's guilty of anything. However, we do know that he's trying to pass very questionable laws to make it difficult for the police to investigate him. I wonder, is this Tel Aviv embassy thing, excuse me, Jerusalem embassy thing, and this, I have no time for Donald Trump, and I know who he is, and I know who he's backed by. I wonder, has he given Netanyahu a bit of a dig out, Tony? Do you know what I mean?
Well, yes, I do know what you mean, but I think the pressure is on Trump too. Look at this, all these threats of impeachment that he's going, and also this Mueller inquiry. It seems to me there's an enormous amount of pressure being put on Trump to behave himself by the Zionist lobby over there. And this is the Christian Zionist lobby is what I'm really talking about, as well as the AIPAC and the Israeli lobby. So this I think is one of the most powerful pressures on Trump at the moment. So he's not necessarily doing what he wants. He's under all this pressure. They're basically, this blackmail really, isn't it? Isn't that the way they do these things?
Pretty much.
I think they say to him, look, you sign on the dotted line, you do as we say, otherwise you're going to have to face impeachment, you're going to have to face this scandal, that scandal, and everything else. And my goodness, Donald Trump, you know, you do think, what on earth is this guy doing in this position? But of course, the other side of the coin is that he's the perfect person from the mafia's point of view for that sort of job, because he will do, I mean, if you know, if you've ever seeing that, there's a wonderful article written about Trump's background in the mafia by William Engdahl called The Mafia Don with a Pompadour. I think it was beginning of last year. It was
yes, yeah, I saw that.
Engdahl is kind of half Russian, half German. Anyway, it's in that he explains the number of times, I think it's five, that you've had Trump has had to go back begging to the mafia to get more money after he's lost it all on one of his casino projects, you know, or whatever. He's been taught discipline. You know, you come back and you get down on your knees, Trump, and you do it, and we'll give you some more money, and off you can go again. He is that, I think, sort of character. He's not his own man. He's just been trained to do what he's told. Even though I think he's quite independent-minded, I don't think he really wants to have these wars. He's been pushed into all these diplomatic decisions by blackmail. That's the way I think this is working. I don't think he quite has the education or the intellect to really battle these people, yeah, you know, on the public stage.
He's leveraged.
So that's
you're
why,
absolutely
that's
right.
That's why he's there, I think.
Listen, you're absolutely right. When his supporters last year were raging against programs like this because we wouldn't support him, and we were saying to people, well, have you not been listening to our programs over the last 10, 11, 12 years? We believe the system is redundant. It doesn't matter who's there. We don't support any of them. But they were really pissed off because they saw any lack of support for Trump as some sort of support for Clinton. But I used to say last year to this audience exactly what you said there. And it's ironic today we're talking about this when Deutsche Bank, you know, have been subpoenaed on the Trump accounts because we heard in the news about the $300 million worth of loans. You nailed it, Tony. This guy has spunked more money down black holes over 35, 40, 45 years than anybody ever. And the fact that he was continually bailed out, but not only bailed out, given more money for these gentrification projects in Manhattan and all the hundreds of millions and billions, was because there would come a day when this guy would be placed in the Oval Office. And however narcissistic and strong-minded he might be, and I think you're bang on, by the way, I think this guy does actually think that he's making decisions. He isn't. He's a neocon Zionist puppet. That's all he is. And people have to wake up to that. and realise there's no answer through the ballot box to this lunatic asylum that we're in.
No, the ballot box is almost a waste of time in America. But, you know, but he's basically been hemmed in. I think that's effectively what's happened. But, you know, the worrying thing is he seems to have a little thing about North Korea, Richie, doesn't he?
Yeah. So what's happening there, Tony? I mean, I know you're going to talk about Russia and the Olympics shortly. There's a lot of comment on that on Twitter, and I'm getting emails about that. But here we have rhetoric. Now, you and I have been around the block a few times, and we've heard a lot of rhetoric, and we've heard a lot of threats, and, you know, a lot of kind of bluster. But this has the sound of something a bit more sinister. This, you know, this bracketing together North Korea and Iran. You have John Bolton on American television. I thought he'd gone from the, you know, from the political scene.
Yeah,
from the political
my
debate.
Fingers crossed on that one too.
Yeah, me too, yeah. But all these guys are coming out and saying, Iran, North Korea, Iran, North Korea, Iran, North Korea. He can't be allowed to get a ICBM that can carry the payload to America. Where's it going, Tony? I mean, do we seriously think it might end up in some sort of Scud missile type attack on targets in North Korea? And if that happens, would they retaliate? They're only a few miles away from Seoul, basically. I mean, they could do any, you know, amount of damage. If I was living in South Korea right now, Tone, I'd be shitting myself, to be honest. What's going on?
Well, I think a lot of them are. A lot of them are demonstrating out on the streets rather than just going down to the, you know, the lavatory. But anyway, North Korea, I think, horrendous. I think the real danger, and I had a chat last week, I don't know if you can manage to get him on your show at some point, to a U.S. Former... I mean, he's a ex-nuclear weapons launch officer, Stephen Gardiner. He's now a professor of anthropology at University of Louisville, Kentucky, and quite an interesting chap. You know what? Of the conversation I have with him, the longest reply I got to my question was when I talked about a nuclear false flag. He was obviously taking this stuff very seriously. And, you know, he had all sorts of interesting things to say about, you know, when nuclear weapons might be used, the sorts of reasons when there's no fear of retaliation. This should be an obvious thing for many people, you know, but this is why the North Koreans have decided to get nuclear weapons and go for a nuclear weapons program, is because they know this is the only way to actually really stop. And I mean, they've looked at Libya, you know, they've looked at Iraq, they've looked at, you know, what's been going on in the Middle East, quite obviously. And also when diplomatic channels are breaking down or when they've broken down, that's when nuclear weapons might be used. Also, if there's a military advantage and there's a temptation of instant victory. You know, this is what he was telling me. But the stuff on the false flags, he says it gives the true aggressor, because obviously, you know, what the scenario we're looking at here is some sort of false flag attack on the US or Guam or US territory of some sort, which is blamed on North Korea, which could then trigger a massive exchange, actually, with the Chinese potentially getting involved. And what he said was that this gives the true aggressor a distinct short-term military advantage. So there's actually a temptation to do this, is what he's saying. So I think it's time to revisit. I'd like to see Panorama have a good look at what would a nuclear war look like? What would a nuclear exchange look like? How would it affect us? I did do a little bit of digging around, and I just say for your listeners, the best place to find stuff on all this is the Stockholm, I think it's called SIP, something or other, Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, SIPRI. And they say, can I try a little quiz with you? Do you know how many nuclear weapons warheads there are out there?
In the world, Jesus, Tony, do you know, I think I watched a report on RT some months ago, and I probably heard the figure, but I can't remember. But it's, it's several thousand, isn't it?
Go on, go, have a guess, go on.
I'll go on for the crack. I'll say 5,500.
16,000.
Mother of Jesus.
I know, it's a lot. Yeah, it's a lot of them. And also, the other thing which I think is worth considering is what would a nuclear winter look like? So this is a nuclear exchange. If there's a nuclear exchange, how many fatalities? So if you don't mind doing the guessing game.
Go ahead.
How many million fatalities do you think there's likely to be if there was a reasonable sized nuclear exchange?
So two countries firing nuclear warheads at one another. It's got to be in the millions, Tony. It's got to be in the tens of millions.
They reckon, and this is the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency in 2002, reckoned 10 million fatalities, roughly 10 million. And followed by, quite a lot more. So 8 to 12 million fatalities initially, followed by many millions later from radiation poisoning. But another interesting side to all this is the nuclear winter. This is something we often forget, but it would have a massive effect. I mean, we're talking about effectively, two of the superpowers, an exchange from two of the superpowers. And the temperature would plunge globally for several months. I'd like to guess how many degrees Celsius?
Oh, Jesus. Yeah. Well, I can't imagine, but you're talking levels of cold that I suppose, most people can't even comprehend.
Go on, have a guess. How many degrees Celsius colder would it get all over the world?
All over the world? 100.
No. Thank God.
50.
No.
50
Not
degrees,
quite
right?
So much. No, it would be 40. They reckon 40 degrees Celsius for several months down. So that means in Egypt, which is hot like 25, that would be minus 15.
Siberia, right.
Yeah, so if you just take away 40 degrees Celsius from whatever your temperature is, like say in the summer in the UK, say 20, that would be down to minus 20. So that would be for several months. After 3 years, it would still be 6 degrees colder. And after 5 years, 3 degrees colder, if you're still alive to look at your thermometer.
But of course, the land is unusable for thousands and thousands of years, right?
Well, not necessarily. Depends where the fallout lands, how much of it lands.
Right.
So it's quite possible you might just about squeeze a few carrots out of the land. I'm not sure. But I think for me, one of the most fascinating sides of all of this is the idea of missing nuclear weapons and nuclear weapons for sale on the black market. Because in 1993, the British journalist Roger Cook was offered for sale a Soviet SS-20.
In fact, he was actually taken
to see it, and this is a
remember this.
This was when the Russians were not paying their soldiers, so the soldiers were selling the kit off to anyone with a few bob in their pocket. But actually, what Roger had done is he'd got several million transferred to a Swiss bank account, so they would check his bank account to make sure he had all these millions. So an SS-20 is a pretty useful piece of kit if you wanted to, you want to fire a nuclear weapon at someone a long way away. And they're quite accurate too. So that's three 150 kiloton warheads. Each can be separately targeted, and they have a range of 3,400 miles. And that each one of those is around about 10 Hiroshima bombs. So, this is a piece of kit which was available to Roger Cook on the black market in 1993.
25 years
so
ago.
I wonder if Roger Cook can get hold of one. Potentially, any government certainly could have been getting hold of these SS-20s.
And people think all you and I, again, being around the block a few times, we'll have heard the term mutually assured destruction. And this has always been the great safety valve. People have always said, well, nobody's going to fire one because they will be just condemning themselves to oblivion because, they might hit their target, but everybody else with nukes will fire them on those countries. But we're not necessarily talking about governments here. We're not talking about governments. We could be talking about rogue elements within governments, rogue elements within countries.
We're talking about the Blackwater mentality, actually, which is private military companies.
Absolutely.
Who could, anyone can commission one of them. Blackwater, for a while on their website, this is probably eight years ago, actually had a page boasting how they can fight a nuclear war for you. Then they took it down after some people remarked about it. There was a couple of news stories. But, these private military companies are basically just, they're now a part of a privatized military in various parts of the world. Thank God we haven't quite gone down that road in Britain yet.
But Tony, it's funny you say we've not gone down that road in Britain, and we might not get a chance to talk about Russia and the Olympics, but because this is a very interesting subject that you're on now. We say they haven't gotten a hold here. G4S are everywhere, Tony. And you know what? I was at a concert recently, and it's about all we do, really, is we go to live music events. And I was speaking to somebody who does part-time work with, not with G4S, but with Oh, begins with S. They're at a lot of the concert venues. No, oh Jesus! It'll come to me in a minute. Anyway, they're a company that does music events. It's not Serco, but a guy working for them also part times with G4S, and he was talking about how, you know, they're bidding for and pressurizing and lobbying for various policing duties to be tendered out ultimately to the. Now, I know you've talked a lot about this over the years, and we'll see it coming. That a lot of these companies, in as we destroy the police force in this country through underfunding and everything else, eventually these companies are going to be taken up to slack. G4S here, Blackwater elsewhere. This is the future, Tony, isn't it? This is the future. These companies running things.
Well, it's, I don't know. I think that there's been a part of the reason that that there's been this Brexit vote, and part of the reason, you know, that Britain is disengaging from this whole European army thing is because there is the feeling that this is the wrong way to go. I think that's quite sensible, even within the Conservative Party, you know, the people who might, you know, might associate more with privatisation. So there is that. But look, the false flag nuclear thing, I really think now, because we've had these failed false flag attempts at false flag attacks in Syria with chemical weapons, I just think that the powers that be, the dark forces, this is their mode of choice. Like, for example, when Netanyahu first became prime minister in Israel, it was false flag attacks that brought him to power. Three false flag attacks in Israel after the big peace rallies and everything. This burst the and he kind of rode to power on this, you know, I'm going to protect everybody, I'm the tough man, I'm the strong man kind of thing. And I think that's the way that the elite think. They just want that kind of thing. And also, I will also say, I think behind the scenes, you've got, I think in most countries, the thing to do is look at what happened in 1981 in Italy with the P2 scandal. That's how things are run, I reckon. Behind the scenes, you've got police chiefs, newspaper owners meeting up in secret, effectively deciding things behind the scenes with intelligence services, with bankers. And that was what was going on in Italy in the P2 scandal. I don't know who these individuals are. I can't name them, but I reckon that's what's going on in most Western countries nowadays.
Tony, just before, that's really important stuff, this is really important, folks. Tony Gosling is on the line. The Politics Show on BCFM is a must listen. I'll tweet out links to it. Also, bookmark Bilderberg.org, which is a collection of information on Bilderberg that Tony's been putting together for many, many, many years. Just before we run out of time, Tony, we've got about 3 minutes left. Russia are banned from the Winter Olympics in Pyeongchang, but their athletes whom are clean, this is ridiculous, can compete as basically non-domiciled, non-country people if they want, as individuals. This is madness. What do you think is going on with this?
Yeah, what I've heard is that they're going to be, I suppose, I mean, there's only one word you can use to describe this. Pathetic. Absolutely pathetic. The idea that, you know, this is just another whip to hit Putin with. And the Russians and the Chinese have shown, I think, an amazing resolve in the Middle East to block this war of terror, these regime changes, this maniacal attempt to balkanize the Middle East, to take over Syria and Iraq, to create absolute chaos and mayhem. The only thing that stopped that happening in Syria is Putin, and this is they're mad as hell at him, so they're having a go. Now, it's just exactly the same sort of thing as we've seen with FIFA as well, and then it seems that because they're being, I mean, it's just so cowardly and pathetic. Because they've been beaten militarily, it's almost like they're having a go at the sort of weak spots. But the thing is, the sport is really important in actually building relationships around the world, in making sure wars don't happen, don't break out, that we can start to take people of a different country, different race, different way of thinking as equals and share the world with them. You know, the idea that someone's different looking or thinking doesn't matter at all. You know, it's great. It's something worth celebrating. And it seems to me there's an attempt to really just blacken Russia's name everywhere. This whole Russia gate business, absolute, complete and utter rubbish. And then it's really just an excuse for the murder of one of the guys who was Seth Rich at the Democratic National Convention, the most appalling bit of lack of investigation by the mainstream press I've seen for decades. That whole, you know, what you've got is a complete rubbish being put out as fact time after time. So it's very much George Orwell's city, isn't it, nowadays? I mean, I suppose we've been saying that ever since we started chatting, but it's just ramping up all the time.
It's ramping up all the time, mate. And I'm optimistic, though, that it's beginning to break water in terms of more and more people are paying attention to it. And I really do believe that, because there's a tiredness and a fatigue amongst people that I meet when I'm out. I know you meet people when you're out as well, and they're turning away from it. They're sick to death of it. Tony can be found on The Politics Show on BCFM every Friday. Terrific show. Check it out.
The easy link for it is thisweek.org.uk. And the show's been suspended for the last couple of weeks, but I hope to be back on Friday. But we still did a show last week at something called the People's Republic for Stokes Croft. So the show is happening anyhow.
It's brilliant, Tony. Thisweek.org.uk, and go to bilderberg.org as well. Thanks for your time, mate. Really appreciate it. Terrific work, Tone.
Okay, you better buy some nice warm clothes to make sure you haven't got the nuclear winter encroaching. But remember, this nuclear is used for fear as well. So just say no.
Absolutely right. And don't be buying any iodine tablets. Not yet, anyway. Cheers, Tony.